And the question is, what is evolution? This is a give and take. I won't go to the next slide until...
There we go.
Organisms adapting and readapting to their environment.
That's a definition. Anyone else?
Environment selection. Okay, it's
survival, selecting, adaptation. Okay, that's very good. So,
okay.
That's the tragedy of having people fool around with the computer.
Did you try the little arrows at the bottom?
Yeah. There we go. So, evolution is change over time. These rubber duckies are just wonderful. It's change over time. And you see on the left, you have a population of little rubber duckies that are, their plumage is all yellow, but there's some variation in there. And on the right, you see rubber duckies with different plumage coloration. And so there's been change over time, assuming that these rubber duckies are biotic. Some people don't think they are, but okay. I think they're cute.
We'll accept them being biotic on faith.
Okay. So how much time is a question that we'll be looking at? And what makes it biological evolution? Because things can change over time. We grow, we get older, we get smarter, we hope. We change, but that's not evolution, that's development. There are things that do change over time. Cultures evolve. But what makes it biological evolution? And it's genetic change over time in a population. So evolution is the adaptation, the genetic changes in a population that allow it to adapt to the environment.
Are they including now the epigenetic changes, or is that strictly temporary?
Epigenetic changes. I wish people wouldn't ask me this because I feel very uncomfortable. And they asked it of me the last time. Epigenetic changes can last several generations. And one of the examples of epigenetic changes is in women, in humans, at least in mammals, we carry two X chromosomes. That means that we have two genes for every protein that we need in our body. But if we make twice as much protein, would that imbalance some of our biochemical pathways? So what happens is that one of the X chromosomes is shut down. And I think it's random throughout the body. And that's called epigenetic. It's an epigenetic silencing of an X chromosome in every cell. Now, don't ask any more questions like that, please.
But you said how many more of the questions are like that?
When I turn purple.
Thank you.
Is that an epigenetic or?
I'm sorry?
Is that an epigenetic change when you go purple?
I'm not going to answer that. So, next. See, I get all my rubber duckies in a row. What traits are required for change? Well, if you have a population that's all the same, you're not going to get much change because there isn't anything to select upon. So you need variation in a population, some kind of variation. And for biological evolution, you need genetic variation. So if there were plumage variations in my duckies in the line, then that has to be genetically based. And plumage coloration actually is genetically based. And we'll talk about it in a little bit because birds are my favorite.
So it has to be real instead of only their hairdresser knowing.
I'm sorry? What did you say?
I said it has to be real, not just a hairdresser knowing for sure.
Yes. So how is variation created? And this gets into one of the more difficult questions with creationists, is that how do, you know, random, how does randomness lead to the evolution of characters that are organized, highly organized, like the vertebrate or the invertebrate eye? I mean, they're extremely well organized. Well, variation is created with random mutations, and mutations occur in the genetic code, and sometimes they result in expression of mutant genes, which can lead to different phenotypes. Phenotypes are what you see. So phenotype can be plumage color, it can be hair color, eye color, it can be body shape, whatever. It's, you know, whether you have four arms or 63 arms, you know, it's what you see, and there's a genetic basis to it, and that's the genotype. So mutations can occur in the genotype, and if they're adaptive, they may be selective. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. So the question for Unitarian Universalists and Quakers, I guess, is that does the randomness of evolution preclude God in our world, our universe? And that's a personal question, I think, more than anything. But if any of you would like to comment on it, oh well. And the assumption in that question is evolution random? The question that's often asked is, how do random forces result in highly structured phenotypes like the eye? Now, mutations are often random. Now, I say often, that's a caveat. Selection chooses those phenotypes with adaptive advantage. So mutations lead to some sort of expression of a phenotype, and if it's adaptive, selection will increase, likely increase the ability of the organism to produce offspring, carrying those genes. Selection, then, isn't random. And that's the critical point in evolutionary change. Evolution isn't a random process, or not often a random process. It can happen randomly. If you have small populations that are isolated, you can have random processes. But most evolution is a structural selective process. Okay, what else is required for evolution? Well, you can have lots of mutations leading to adaptive genes, and if you have lots of resources for individuals to reproduce equally, you won't get much selection, because selection is actually the differential reproduction among individuals. Individuals that are more adaptive are fit than others will leave more genes for the following generation, or number of generations, you both. And limiting resources leading to competition among individuals for food or mates or territories or whatever is what squeezes or what actually determines whether selection is going to occur or not. So individuals that are not as good at attracting mates won't leave as many genes to the next generation as other individuals. Do you know what leks are? Where there are bird communities where males will congregate in a certain area and only dominant males will attract females, and then you have all of these subdominant males on the outside that don't really contribute. Actually, they do, because they cheat. But
they sneak in.
Yeah. There's a lot of cheating going on in evolution. But the dominant males, theoretically, are the ones who contribute more to the following generation. Now, in purple martens, it was discovered through DNA fingerprinting that the dominant male, there was one dominant adult male and the rest were sub-adult males with their mates. And with fingerprinting, it was discovered that the dominant male sired most of the young for the next generation. There was cheating going on as the young males were, going out to feed. The young females kind of got it on with the dominant male. So, the dominant male is producing or transferring more genes to the next generation.
And that sort of speaks against altruism.
I'm sorry?
That speaks against altruism.
I'm sorry.
There can't be any altruism.
Altruism was a real thorny issue for a long time because, why would one, this is eye candy, by the way, for why would, an individual sacrifice its future reproduction for another individual? And we see this in honeybees and in ants, where you have a queen that produces all of the young for the next generation, and there are a couple of males that are just there for a short period of time to inseminate the queen, and then you have all of these females that are not on reproducing, but they take care of the queen and the hive. And what is the advantage to them? Well, it turns out that they're all related in such a way that when the queen passes on genes to the next generation, she's passing on genes that belong to all of them. So this was a successful evolutionary way of being able to pass on your genes without actually directly reproducing. Now, I talked about fit in the last slide. And the question is this gentleman fit evolutionarily? You don't know. If you don't know what his reproduction is, you don't know if he's fit. Now, what is fit? Is this woman fit evolutionarily, assuming that all the children in the slide are hers?
She's reproducing,
she's passing on her genes. So if all the children in the slide are hers, then she's fit. Relative to other people, I don't know. But if her children survive to reproductive age, she's fit. Here's an example of a couple who have six children and multiple grandchildren. Are they fit? Do I see yes? Mm-hmm. Turns out they adopted their children. So they're not passing on their genes. This is a case of altruism, by the way. They were going to adopt four children. Well, they were going to have two children and adopt two, and they couldn't have children, so they started adopting and got twins for the first adoption, and they got a little boy the next time. They were going out for a little girl to balance the gender ratio. The little boy needed a home, so they adopted the boy, and they went out and adopted a little girl the next time to give a sister for the older sister. And they were sitting at home one Christmas, and they get a call from the adoption agency saying, we have a little boy that needs a home. So they adopted him. He is now an adult, and his wife is pregnant with twin girls. So the grandparents are not evolutionarily fit because they didn't pass on their genes, but the children are. Evolution requires inherited variation among individuals, and I I showed you, if you have those ducks in a line with no variation, you're not going to get selection. Evolution requires competition for limiting resources. This is a lion competing for food with hyenas. And if the lion can't keep the hyenas at bay, it will feed and likely reproduce and pass on its gene. If it can't, it won't. Evolution requires differential reproduction or passing on your genes. So the picture on the right is a spider with all little spiders on its back. I love this slide. And the picture on the right is a gorilla with a single individual. There are, within species, there are different strategies for reproduction. In humans, you can have large families or small families, but in gorillas, for example, the number of young is only one, usually only one, maybe two. In deer, you seldom get 20 unless the doe is heterozygous and in a very productive area where she's getting plenty of food. This was determined on the Savannah River Ecology Lab study, looking at differences in twinning in deer on the reservation. So you do have different strategies among species, but this
one of the deer, it's interesting. The deer is, if they're in really poor conditions, the female deer reabsorbs her embryos.
I'm sorry?
The female deer, if she's really in poor nutritional state, will reabsorb her embryos and have no babies.
Yeah.
It's the same way that she's got wonderful nutrition, she'll twin, but she'll go the other way and she's actually pregnant. She just reabsorbs the embryos and doesn't have any.
Exactly. And that's a good strategy for her. Because she doesn't have to expend.
She survives.
Yeah, she survives for another reproduction in a better year. So there are species that do well producing only a single individual every year or 6 years or whatever. And there are species that require lots of babies in order to pass on their genes to the next generation, because a lot of these babies are eaten.
So presumably something's eating them.
There's a lot of difference in the same thing.
So do individuals evolve? Do we evolve? Am I evolving?
No.
It's the populations that evolve. And you observe changes in gene frequencies in a population as evolution. You don't observe gene frequency changes in an individual because you're representing only one.
Except for the epigenetics. But we won't talk about that.
I think I'm turning purple.
Before we jump to you, no.
Behave.
No, that's a very, very interesting question. And I might point out, I think, Robert, you know about the reading group, the evolution reading group at the university. On Fridays at 2:15, I shouldn't say that, a group of people, mostly retired professors and some non-professors and students, get together and will read a book that pertains to evolution. So the last book they read was Svante Paabo's Neanderthal, and discussion of how he managed to look at their genomes. The next book they're going to read is a short one on Ebola. If you're interested in getting involved in the reading group, it's an excellent group. It's got some really interesting people, and if you're interested, contact me and I'll put you in touch with the right people. Oh, don't go to sleep. I get bored too.
Every week?
Well, yeah, they sit there. No, they're not reading a book a week.
That's what I was just thinking.
No. No, and I haven't been able to participate as much because of changes in job. And I realized I have 4 books stacked up where I've only read half of them. So I have to go home and read a bunch. So selection is on the individual, but evolution is not. And this diagram is supposed to show how there are gene frequency changes, and several people have don't like this diagram. So I will just quickly go through it. On the left, you have a population with various genes in various colors, and you have, and there are 30 individuals carrying various genes. On the right, you have a population that's been reduced to 16 individuals, and the ones that are most hit are the red X's. And so you have a gene frequency change, and it's against the red X's. And as a result of the decrease in the number of individuals, you have increases in frequencies of Y, for example, going from 27% to 50%. Or the blue X's go from 7% to 12.5%, although even though their representation is the same from population to population. It's the background that's important.
Why do you have that increase in percentage of Y?
Because what you're doing is you're looking at the number of individuals carrying Y and dividing it by the total population. And so that's the frequency of the Y gene in the population.
Proportion changes.
So you get more guys.
I wasn't even thinking about sex here.
Yeah, see, there's a notice. It doesn't have anything about sex. Because of the territory.
It's just to give you an idea of how gene frequencies change in a population, how they can be. Now, is the endpoint of evolution always speciation? Yes or no? Mm-hmm. Let's vote. Oh, good, you guys. Okay, well, I shouldn't be here. Darwin's finches on Daphne Major in the Galapagos have been studied for over 40 years by Peter and Rosemary Grant. And Daphne Major is this little volcanic island that the only way to get onto it is if your boat, you come in on a boat and the waves, you know, the tide raises and lowers the boat. And if you can jump to a little ledge when you're at the right height, you can study Darwin's finches. If you can't, you're selected against, you're not
there. Finches can do this?
Pardon?
Finches can do this? They swim
out. No, no, yeah. No, the finches are on the island, and they fly back and forth. No, it's the Grants and their crew that have to do this.
Oh, my goodness.
Sounds like epigenetics. changing their beak size for a few years and then coming back to it.
Well, it turns out that what the Grants have found is that they were only going to study these finches on this island for a few years, and then they were going to start manipulating the populations. But before they started manipulating the populations, there was a drought. And they noted that, pardon?
Mother Nature manipulated for them.
And there was a drought, and it reduced the food that they could eat. And a lot of, they say that they saw a lot of dead birds on the island. They had tagged every single individual. Uh-huh. And during the drought, they would run across, you know, someone that they knew. But it turns out that one of the food sources had small berries, and that disappeared basically during the drought. What was left was something with big berries. And those individuals in the population that had slightly larger beaks could handle those berries and eat enough to support themselves, at least for reproduction. No whispering. What did you say?
The big berry was Chuck Berry, but I
big bopper one.
But what the grants noted was that over several years of drought conditions, the bill sizes of these finches, of the progeny of these finches grew, became bigger and bigger, so they could handle the larger berries. That's evolution, that's change in over time, and it's genetically based.
So the berries, evolution trying to not get eaten.
That's another issue. So it looked like the finches were moving toward larger beaks in this population. But when the drought broke, the beaks started becoming smaller because the smaller berries were more abundant, and individuals were responding to the abundance of food, which were smaller berries. And so what you see is the zigzag pattern. You see increases in bill size and then decreases in bill size, increase and decrease depending on the environment. And over time, what you might see is no change at all. Huh? And what's amazing is that the grants and their crew can measure bill sizes to, a tenth of a millimeter. They're really, really accurate in their measurements, so that when they see less than a millimeter change, they know that it's happening. Now, I don't know if any of you know, but I run the Bird Observatory on campus, and what we do is we're looking at how tallgrass prairie bird communities change as the tallgrass prairie is changing. And we do measure bill sizes, but we're doing it with a lot of people who have never used calipers before. And so we have a lot of variance in terms of our measurements, but the grants are just really very, very specific and would never hire me, I guess. Anyway, the Darwin's finches on Daphne Major is an example of evolution, but you don't get speciation with the bill size changes in this particular example. But the grants have lived or worked on this island for 40 years, and they observed a hybrid bird flying in to the island one year, and it had a strange song, and it colonized Daphne Major, and it attracted a mate, and they produced progeny. And then the progeny only bred among themselves, not with the other finches on the island. So they established reproductive isolation, which is what is considered to be the species barrier. And this is an example of sympatric speciation, meaning it occurs in the same area as another species. There's no geological barrier between them. They could have bred with the others, but they didn't. Now, Ernst Mayr, does anyone know Ernst Mayr? He was an evolutionist that actually defined reproductive isolation as defining species. And one of his students, Guy Bush, went out and looked at Ragulides, a species of fruit flies that was, I think it was endemic to cherries, wild cherries. And when Johnny Appleseed came along and started planting apples, and apples and cherries are in the same family, the fruit flies moved to the apples as well. Well, they did their courtship and reproduction on the fruit itself. So what happened is that you had sympatric speciation, in the sense that one group of fruit flies is breeding on apples and the other is breeding on cherries and there's no interchange of genes. And Ernst Mayr said, well, it depends on what you consider the same area. He said, I consider the fruit the same area, not the area where the trees were. So, well, anyway.
So did they associate them with fruit flies?
Yeah, they, because there's no gene flow. And so they set up, you know, it was a basic
so
reproductive
apple,
isolating.
So now you got your apple fruit uh-huh. flies and you got your cherry fruit uh-huh. flies.
Mm-hmm. How fast is evolution? Does it take 30 minutes? 40 years?
I would think that depends on how quickly whatever you're working with is breeding.
That's true. That's a very good variable.
The
yeah.
Generation.
Yeah. So
requires multiple yeah. generations to have phenological evolution.
Well, E. coli, for example, under good conditions, can grow double their populations in 30 minutes. So you can get very, you know, you expect to have more rapid evolution. But we just talked about a situation with beak size changes on Daphne major, and that happened over several generations, and it was observed by the grants. So the theory, though, is that structural genes are those that produce a protein, for example, lactose. And that makes up the phenotype. So if a structural gene produces melanin, which is a pigment that colors your eyes and your hair and your feathers, etc., then you have your phenotype in terms of color. Well, all cells in a body have the same genes, but not all cells are the same, producing the same products. And so it was observed that, geez, some genes have to be turned on in cells and others have to be turned off, especially during development. And it the model moved to the observation that the Jacques Monod model of gene regulation revolutionized how genes are turned off and on, because they looked at a beta-galactose structural gene and looked at how it was regulated. And this was in bacteria, but as soon as they published their work, everyone realized, oh my gosh, gene regulation is really important. And you're not going, and at the time, most studies on genetics in organisms was using biochemical systematics or looking at the products of genes and not thinking about their regulators. And there are elements in the genome that turn genes on and off, and it depends on where they are in the hierarchy. You can have this global regulator that turns on or off a bunch of genes, or you could have a regulator at the structural gene side that just turns that one gene off and on. So depending on where the regulator is in the hierarchy, you can get major evolutionary change, especially if it's higher up. So the thinking is that small mutations in a regulatory gene can have significant impact on the phenotype. You can get really rapid evolution.
Is this the explanation for the breeding they were doing with wolves to dogs, where they bred the calmest, most handleable ones, and they also got some of the other characteristics?
It turns out that the regulatory gene was changed. Possibly. It turns out that if you have selection on a particular character, other characters will evolve with it that are important to it. So if you, yeah.
So it happens so rapidly, yeah. That's why I'm wondering if it was a regulatory gene.
Of course, yeah, uh-huh. My research, and I may talk about it in a minute, my research was on looking at how two species of birds in Haiti well, whether they were good species, and then once I established that, because I assume, pre-assumed they were, how they might have evolved so quickly, because they were, it looked like they had diverged just a few tens of thousands of years, you know, 50,000 years, I forget what the number was, but it looked like it was fairly rapid evolution, and that there wasn't a whole lot of change between the one species and the one species resembled the juvenile of the other. But I could show through gene flow that there was no gene flow, so there was reproductive isolation.
I have a question.
Sure.
And I'm going to use an analogy that came to my mind. You're talking now about a gene either being active or inactive for, I guess, reasons related to enzymes. And my model for that would be a lamp. It's either on or off. I always thought that evolutionary, or changes that grow into evolution, if they were not destructive changes, would be more like replacing an incandescent bulb with one of these new screw-on fluorescent bulbs. And it's a different mechanism. Isn't the different mechanism still part of our understanding of evolution?
But it turns out that a lot of body features in animals, especially like the Hox genes, which are regulatory genes. Sean Carroll at the university has played around with Hox genes, and if you turn on Hox genes sort of regulate development down the length of the body, and if you turn on one Hox gene before another segment has been made, you can get arms or legs coming out of the eye in a Drosophila. So it depends on, you can get major body transformations with changes in regulation. There are things that, legs can be.
There are different kinds of events. There are turn it on, turn it off kinds of events. There are the chemicals didn't come together correctly events, and there's radiation caused something to not bond that it was supposed to kinds of events. I see those as very different, but any of those could be the driver for the change.
Radiation would increase mutations too, and so it would affect development. So what the model was until the 70s and 80s was that that scientists had assumed that dramatic alterations in the body and the phenotype would require the accumulation of many chance mutations in many different genes, and those were structural genes. So if you asked an evolutionist how long would it take to evolve something, it would take a long time. Now, evo-divo evolution development researchers are finding that the evolution of complex new forms can be accomplished by much simpler processes, mutations in regulatory genes, just turning on and off something, and modifying existing developmental plans. New forms can arise through new uses of existing genes, in particular the control genes that oversee development. So the idea before was that you had a mutation in a structural gene, it had to increase in the population before it was seen by selection, and then if it were favorable, and then it would take a long time, and there was chance and there was selection. But they figured that evolution was a very long and tedious process, whereas changes in regulatory genes can occur very, very quickly, affect the phenotype very quickly. Bird feathers and colors are an example of how quickly changes in, bird feathers are comprised of the color in bird feathers are comprised of pigment. And we've talked about the Hox genes and duplication of body parts. Now, these are Hispaniola and palm tanagers. And if the bird on the right is found throughout most of Hispaniola, and the bird, I'm sorry, the bird on the left, the bird on the right is, so the bird on the left is a black-crowned palm tanager. Its juvenile form is gray-crowned. The bird on the right is a gray-crowned palm tanager, and its range is basically the southern part of Haiti. It's the only bird endemic only to Haiti. And what I found was that not only was there very little, if any, gene flow between the two populations, and this, the bird on the right, the gray-crowned palm tanager, was often confused with juveniles of the black-crowned palm tanager because they both had gray. But it turns out that the bird on the right differs. It is reproductively isolated, but it looks like the juvenile phenotypically. It feeds like the juvenile, and it can be derived from the juvenile form given an island colonization model. And during the Pleistocene and Pliocene, there were sea level rises and decreases, so that parts of the island were separated. And we think that this the ancestors of this particular bird colonized the South Island without any kind of competition.
And the sea was high.
Pardon?
And the sea was high and it separated.
Yeah. And the sea level rises correspond to the divergence estimates I had for these two species. Now, it turns out that plumage is a very, very interesting phenotype that can be easily regulated. In the species, you see black, white, gray, and gray, green. Four colors. Now, the four colors are due to two pigments. The white is the absence of pigment in the feather. The black is the total appearance of melanin throughout the feather structure. The gray is, so a feather is like a tree. It has the trunk or shaft, it has branches coming out, and then it has twiglets coming out from that. And it turns out that the gray is a result of white in the shaft and parts of the twiglets having melanin. It gives an overall gray color. The gray-green is due to that pattern superimposed on a yellow shaft. So you get the different patterns, and then four different patterns with only two pigments, and they're easily regulated. You deposit a pigment or you don't deposit a pigment. And so I think one of the reasons that birds are evolutionarily so diverse is because they rely on regulatory gene evolution more than other groups do. Although Stephen Jay Gould didn't think so. So there's some critical questions we can come up with. Why did the chicken cross the road?
Nice question.
This is not very difficult, guys. I guess. Yeah, to get to the other side. Why did it want to get to the other side? This is a little more difficult.
Because that's where the dinner was.
Food or chickens is the other gender.
Actually, it was to get to its dentures. Turns out that chickens or birds are derived from dinosaurs. And at one point, they had teeth. And if you place mouse epithelium in the mouth of a chicken embryo, it will form enamel, as you see in a tooth. It suggests that chickens still have genes that work for tooth formation, at least some of the genes that work, not completely. And it's a matter of turning them on. So we have John Fallon at the University of Wisconsin is doing research on chicken's teeth. And
hen's teeth.
I'm sorry?
Hen's teeth.
No longer rare.
Rooster's cheeks.
So we, all of us, carry genes that were once functional, but for some reason they are not turned on. And if they sit around long enough, they'll accumulate mutations so that even if they were turned on, they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't operate correctly. Evolutionary rates can change thousands of times faster than originally realized, and that's from the Grants work. And as I said, they spent 35 years observing Darwin's finches, and they saw the increase in bill size and then the decrease in bill size, and they measured it, and it was far faster than anyone thought. Can we observe speciation? I think I may have said. So it turns out that I did I talk about this?
Yes,
okay. So you know the answer. We can observe speciation. And they did observe speciation.
St. Patrick, right?
It's St. Patrick speciation, yeah. I should go back and think this through a little more. Contrary to contrarians, there's ample evidence for evolution. And one piece of evidence that no one expected is that we share ancient genes. And one of the genes that's an example of this are the Hox genes that help regulate body size and pattern, cytochrome C and some of the opsins that help us see color. And they go back to the base of the animal phylogeny. Does anyone know how to say the T word?
Tectonic.
Does anyone know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Scandinavian.
it's a fish pod. A lot of arguments from some people who don't buy evolution is that there aren't transitional forms. And this is where paleobiologists predicted where they might find a transitional form between a fish and a tetrapod, and they predicted in what layer of rock that they would see it. Then they looked at their world map and they looked at where this rock was exposed. And one area where it was exposed was in the Canadian Arctic. So they got some money and they went up to the Canadian Arctic in the summer and dug. And I think it was on their last day there.
The third expedition.
Pardon?
Of the third expedition.
Uh-huh. They were not going to be able to come back because they were out of money. They accidentally found this fossil, Tiktaalik. And it lived 375 million years ago. And it has a combination of fish and tetrapod traits, such as scales, fins, gills, and lungs. And it has a flexible neck with ribs, a flat head, eyes on top, and the fin skeleton. So this is an intermediate form between fish and tetrapods.
And he said when they saw that flat head sticking out, that's when they knew.
Uh-huh.
Because fish heads are this way.
It was like a crocodile.
Mm-hmm. It was just saw only that much, and they had it.
So these are really, really old organisms. Let me see. I think the next slide shows it. Yeah, there's the flat-headed.
Oh my.
Yeah, they're not very pretty, but
It's like an alligator.
They figured that they lived in shallow waters, that they needed lungs to get more oxygen, rather, because they couldn't pull it from the waters, because they were moving around in shallow waters, they had fins that developed into legs eventually. Oh, not in them, but evolved as legs. And here's a fishapod drawing. So in summary, evolution is genetic change in a population. It doesn't always lead to speciation, and it's not a random process. And it's much faster than anyone thought. The mechanism for evolution is selection, which sculpts adaptive change in a species. And mutations, random mutations, provide the material for selection to act upon. So you do have randomness in the process, and the mechanism is selection, which is non-random. It selects for adaptive changes. And what Darwin didn't know was that we do share ancient genes since the beginning of animal phyla, and there may be some sharing with plants and other organisms. Modest changes in regulatory genes can shape body forms fairly rapidly. Rapid evolutionary change can happen. Darwin believed in gradual evolution. Because that's what he was seeing in the fossil record. And according to Stephen Jay Gould, he was trying to contrast his theory with creationism, sudden appearance. And so he felt slow evolution was an important character of his theory. Contrary to what people think, speciation can be observed, which is fun. And it's a really an exciting time in evolutionary change, in evolution theory, because there's the molecular basis that allows examination of what's going on at the genetic level, but you can also see changes in the phenotype and in the behavior. And I imagine there's epigenetic stuff going on too. Are there questions or comments?
I wonder if you could comment on all the different disciplines that have been drawn together by the James F. Kuo Institute at the university. There's so many different fields now that contribute to evolution.
Right. We have 20 departments within our institute. Does anyone know Jim Kuo, or did you know Jim Kuo? Not only did he enjoy being working with the NAACP with his name, but he was an outstanding population geneticist. He was hired at the university in 1948. In 2010, we launched the J.F. Kuo Institute for the Study of Evolution while he was still alive, and he said, most things are not named after anyone until they die, but I'm not taking the hint. He was a remarkable man. He had a paper that he was working on when he finally died several years ago. But he's been involved in so much in evolutionary studies, including DNA fingerprinting. He was the one who was on a panel that convinced, of course, that DNA fingerprints were unique. He has been involved in radiation studies. He was involved in pesticide resistance and Drosophila, and many, many, many more things. And hopefully, his 100th birthday is in 2016, and hopefully we will have a Darwin Day, which is February 12th or thereabouts. But we'll have, we always celebrate Darwin Day every year. Have any of you been to it?
No.
Okay, it's at February 12th. But in 2016, we're hoping to devote it to what Jim Crow has given to the area of evolution. Talk about his research and bring in his students who are all world-renowned, or not all, but many are world-renowned. Jim certainly was. I mean, he also looked, anyone know about jumping genes? About how genetic elements move around the genome and insert into others? Well, that actually can be a means of changing regulation. For example, in the mouse, there's a pellage pigment gene, and in its normal form, it gives a dark color to the fur, but if there's this retroviral-like element that jumps in the middle of it, then the fur is much lighter. So, and in Drosophila, it's been noted that when they're under stress, there's a lot more movement of genes within the genome. And the idea is that they're trying desperately to find something adaptive to the environment they're in so that they can survive it. So Jim, yeah, did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I know. There are 20 departments, and that includes anthropology, biochemistry, genetics, geosciences, horticulture. We have history of science. We have zoology. We have botany. And that's only 7, but we have a bunch of others, and they're all involved in some form of evolutionary change or evolutionary studies. And we do have a website. It's www, I should put it up there, evolution.wisc.edu. And you can go on and see who's in our group, and you can subscribe to the newsletter if you'd like. We put out, it's not a newsletter, but we put out announcements about seminars, upcoming seminars and upcoming fora and things like Darwin Day.
And that's on the web.
That's on the web, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not a physical one, but on the web one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much, Mara.
Well, thank you. Thank you.